And as we agreed in the previous session, we will give the floor to Mr. Mohamed Ould Salek, FAO Special Ambassador for International Family Farming for North Africa and Near East, for his comments on the previous session. Please, Mr. Ould Salek, you have the floor.
Merci. Je suis l'ambassadeur, s'il vous plaît, pour le nord de l'Afrique et le Moyen-Orient. Je suis spécialiste dans la pêche artisanale. Je présente 35 000 familles pêcheurs. Et aujourd'hui, je vais seulement insérer quelques mots qui servent exactement. Ils font partie de l'agriculture familiale, qui est la pêche artisanale. Parce que ça se fait au niveau de la famille. Spécialement au niveau de la famille. L'agriculture familiale est transcendante et son entend point de vie, la génération de l'alimentation à partir du moyen familial. Groupe spécial résident le vrai potentiel de ce concept. Dans notre monde actuel, environ 90% de la pêche mondiale provient de la pêche artisanale. Emploi approximatif concernant un nombre d'hommes et de femmes. Les femmes servent la transformation à terre, le séchage, le fumage et la distribution locale. L'agriculture internationale, familiale, de fenêtre donne aussi l'importance à port de pêche artisanale de petite échelle à l'amélioration du monde de vie. Pour résumer ce qui précède, il faut mentionner les bénéfices spécifiques que les activités des initiatives promulguées durant l'année 30 avec les clairs exemples de celles-ci à l'adoption de récentes des directions internationales visant la durabilité de la pêche à petite échelle. De la part de 143 membres du comité de pêche de FAO, pour la pêche, cela a représenté un passé précédent et il constitue le premier instrument international dans son genre, développement spécifique ayant pour l'objectif la pêche à petite échelle. Nos besoins en tant que pêcheurs et intérêts, c'est l'expliquer que ce pays initiative renonce la protection de modes de vie authentiques accessibles s'il a engendré quotidien de modes de pêche uniquement effi en honorable génération qui contribue au progrès humanitaire pour le, depuis plus de 10 milliards d'années. Toutefois, le travail n'est pas encore terminé, il importe de maintenir des conditions pour lesquelles on contient des racines même d'où provient notre héritage culturel. Souvenons-nous que la pêche artisanale contribue aux larges mesures à la sécurité alimentaire du pays, à la promotion d'une nourriture appropriée. Tout ce qui précède fait partie de l'ensemble des solutions stratégiques de continu. Et à la même occasion, je demande au FAO de mettre en priorité, s'il vous plaît, les familles qui sont démunies par la sécheresse de la culture, d'envoyer les enfants dans la pêche. Cette année, la Mauritanie, avec l'aide de la Banque mondiale, nous les artisans, on a absorbé 1800 jeunes qui appartiennent à deux familles qui ont perdu leur agriculture, ont été insérés dans la famille de pêche. Je vous remercie. Je vous continue une bonne continuation, s'il vous plaît.
Muchísimas gracias, señor Ould Salek, por su intervención. Quisiera sacar otra vez que la labor que FAO está llevando sobre para la agricultura familiar es una labor para la agricultura familiar entendida en su conjunto de diversidad, en la cual también hay una fuerte participación de los pescadores, las pescadoras artesanales, que son un componente estratégico de este sector de agricultura familiar, que obviamente no es solamente un sector, más es un modo de vida, y sabemos muy bien cómo el cuidado de la labor que los pescadores y las pescadoras artesanales llevan adelante en su trabajo diario, cotidiano, es un componente importante de este modo de vida que es la agricultura familiar. Por lo tanto, muchísimas gracias por su intervención. Bueno, y estamos en una condición de trabajar una hora y la segunda sesión de este panel que va a reproducir la dinámica que tuvimos antes, o sea, las intervenciones, las ponencias de los profesores panelistas, después las reacciones de los comentaristas, que también en este caso son los embajadores especiales de la Organización de la Cultura Familiar. Quisiera decir también que los papers de los autores, las versiones breves, son short papers, son publicados en una publicación que se llama Deep Roots, y que ya está online y que será impresa y será lista para noviembre, creo. Y también que las versiones más cumplidas, la longest version, irán a constituir una policy series de FAO sobre agricultura familiar, así que pueden ser disponibilizados también más o menos en noviembre, final de noviembre, información para que los textos, los autores puedan ser leídos por todos los participantes en este diálogo global. Sin demora, ahora nosotros tenemos tres intervenciones del profesor John Eichert sobre agricultura familiar en América del Norte, del profesor Yao Douan de Plogue, me disculpe la non dominancia del acento, de la Wageningen University, Netherlands, y el profesor Sergio Schneider también va a hacer la síntesis del paper sobre Asia, porque desafortunadamente el profesor Ye Jingzong no ha podido atender a este diálogo global por compromiso que había ya tomado antes. Y por eso, sin demora, yo le paso la palabra al profesor John Eichert, Professor Emeritus, University of Missouri, USA. Please, Professor John Eichert, you have the floor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be on this distinguished panel and to be involved in this forum. I'm going to give you a very brief overview of the paper that I prepared on family farms of North America, which is much longer. When we look at the situation of family farms in North America today, sadly to say, I believe that we've lost many, if not most, of our true family farms in the United States and Canada, and to a lesser extent, possibly in Mexico. It's difficult to know. We have to guess, because the definitions of family farms, particularly in the United States and Canada, include virtually all farms, to a lesser extent in Mexico. But if we look at what true family farms are and what distinguishes them in ways that are important as we look to the future with respect to sustainability, a family farm is a way of life. It's not just a way to make a living for the family. As a consequence of that, a family farm is inseparable from the farm and the farm from the family. A farm with a different family would be a different farm, and a family with a different farm would be a different family on a true family farm. As a consequence of that, the farming operation and the management reflects the social and the ethical values of the family and not just the economic values that they're pursuing. And it's this connectedness, this intentional multifunctionality that distinguishes them in an important way. Because when we look at a farm, it has inevitable social and ecological consequences as well as its economic consequences, but a true family farm is managed to, and all of those functions are expressed in the way it's managed. In the United States and much of the rest of the world, as we focused on economic efficiency to try to provide greater food security through reducing the cost of food, we've moved toward what I would call a monofunctional family farming operation, or a family farm that expresses positively the economic values, but with inevitable negative social and ecological consequences. A farm, I can tell you as an agricultural economist, that's dominated by the pursuit of economic efficiency, quite simply, is not sustainable. The challenges that we're facing today are challenges that have been brought on through farm policies that have been promoting the monofunctionality of farming operations in the pursuit of greater economic efficiency, and I include public research and education in those public policies as well. As a consequence, they've been very effective in bringing about farms that are more specialized, standardized, and consolidated into larger and larger farming operations and increasingly under control of the large agribusiness corporations through comprehensive production contracts. As a consequence of this, we see various other challenges that are facing family farms today, such as the aging farmers, because there simply have not been opportunities for new farmers to come in at earlier ages. Because of the size of the farm, We face problems of access to the land and capital for new farmers that would like to get involved in family farming operations. Fortunately, I spend much of my time in my old age with a new group of family farmers who come in under what we call sustainable agriculture in the international community, more like ecological or agroecology. These farmers are motivated by the ecological, social, and economic consequences of their farming operations in balance and in harmony. These farmers have difficulty getting access to land and capital because they don't fit the stereotypical image of a family farm in the United States. They face an additional challenge because if we're to replace the industrial food system with this new sustainable food system, then these farmers have to work together and cooperate if they're to avoid the pitfalls of having to grow ever larger and more industrial in their operations. When we look to farm policies that might change the directions, we need to move from farm policies that pursue food security based on increasing economic efficiency through monofunctionality and move toward food policies that face food security and food sovereignty through programs that are focused on sustainability and thus support multifunctional family farms as opposed to the monofunctionality. We could begin by de-emphasizing and phasing out the commodity programs that focus on specific commodities that allow farmers to specialize, standardize, and grow larger. And that would include specific crop insurance in that category as well. We could use the money saved there to move toward whole farm insurance that would ensure the income of the whole farm and provide incentives with reduced premiums for those farms that are diverse and therefore have less economic risk. If we're to provide opportunities for people to have access to land, we have to have major sort of transformation in our land tenure policies that bring us back to some concept of the commons without sacrificing right to the land, but removing the speculative pressures that we see today from outside speculation on land prices. We need to focus farm policies on families, not just on farms. The limits to the farm to the payments should be limited not by the size of the farm, but the size of the family. We need to focus on people rather than production. To the extent that benefits are available within a country, we need to provide farmers with such things as health care and workers' compensation and even vacation time and holidays like any other worker within that particular country. I realize that wouldn't be possible in all countries, but in the United States and Canada, it certainly would be. We need to move for programs that focus on providing community-based local food systems. We can build national and international networks of local commodity or local-based food systems and move away from focusing on the global food system, which forces you toward the emphasis on competitiveness that leads you away from true family farms. We need family farms. We have to have multifunctional family farms if we're to have a future. These family farms that are multifunctional have the unique potential and the motivation to express their social, their ethical, and their cultural values and the way they operate their farms. That multifunctionality is absolutely essential for food security in the short run and for the sustainability of humanity over time. Thank you.
Thank you very much indeed, Professor John Eichert. As I told before in the previous session, the reason why I'm not commenting your intervention as the audience is just because of lack of time. I would very much like to have some interaction with you on these issues, relevant issues that you raised, but I prefer to leave time to our panelists and eventually the debate later. Having said this, I now pass the floor to Professor Jan Do van de Ploeg, Wageningen University, the Netherlands. Thank you very much, Professor.
Thank you, Chairman. And let me tell you, your pronunciation is excellent. No problem with that. Ladies and gentlemen, I will say a few things about family farming in Europe and Central Asia. The good news, anyway, is that in contrast with the United States of America, in Europe and Central Asia, family farming is kicking and alive. It's having problems, many problems, but there's also a strength in it, a few elements of which I will bring to the floor. In Europe and Central Asia, family farming clearly is the dominant form of agricultural production. Take the European Union, for instance, 27 countries. It's having nearly 12 million farms. 97% of these are family farms. The same applies to Central Asia, family farming is omnipresent. The only exceptions, relative exceptions, are Russia and Kazakhstan. Family farming is the main land labor institution in this part of the world. It is the institution that ties together family and farm, family and land and labor in a strong way. And in doing so, it assures agricultural production and it assures as well the continuity over time. The strengths, productivity, resilience, and also the attractiveness of family farming resides in the fact that it combines what is separated in other forms of production. Family farming combines labor and the ownership of the main resources, and by doing so, it evidently renders considerable autonomy to the farming family. It also allows the family and its prospects to be in the center of decision making. Family farm combines mental and manual labor. Family farm combines in one and the same place a living and working and the education of children who have a nice place to grow up. It connects short and long term, just as it connects different generations. And very important, in many places, it connects directly production and consumption. It connects the family farm dedication to the hardship it entails often on the one hand and getting the results on the other hand. It is the family farming represents the axis between skills on the one hand and pride about the final production on the other hand. All this implies that family farming is far more than just an economic unit. It's a way of realizing agricultural production. It's a way to link with nature. And it's also a livelihood, as has been stressed by my colleagues. It's a way of life, and not just a way of life. It's a way of life that is very dear to people involved in it, who are ready to defend it at considerable costs. It's also the outcome of long and many-faceted processes of emancipation that we witnessed in Europe and Central Asia. Europe and Central Asia show that family farming is not necessarily about being small. The continent shows that the art of farming, as entailed in family farming, this art of farming can be practiced in small, in medium, and even in larger farms. However, at the same time, you have to acknowledge, of course, that family farming, also in Europe and in Central Asia, it's in a deep crisis. This deep crisis is not existing only in the Global South. We live through it in Europe and Central Asia as well. A considerable part of European family farmers are living below the legally defined minimum level of income and are fighting in all possible ways to improve their situation. The main challenges, let me refer to a few of the major ones. The first major challenge in Europe is that family farm continues to offer ample opportunities for self-employment and income generation, and this applies especially to young people, of course. Another challenge is to continue to be the cornerstone of food security and of food sovereignty, to be the cornerstone as well of regional economies. It's a main challenge to face the new scarcities, energy, water, fertile soils, climate. And here is the big promise of helping to cool the earth by applying agroecology. Policy environment over the last decades has been relatively friendly to family farming, especially in Europe, although over the last decade it deteriorated as in so many other places. I will point to, will give 5 points where the policy environment in Europe is to be strengthened, and these are also points discussed in the regional debates and in many other arenas in Europe. First, there is a very strong grassroots movement throughout Europe that results in the construction of farmers' markets all over the place. The Ministry of Hungary this morning cited this need to construct new market outlets, new marketplaces, and especially here in the city of Rome, you can find beautiful mercati contadini, peasant markets in the city, which offer family farmers a better slice of the cake, an increase in the share of the value added. And this is very important, of course, that this is strengthened and supported by authorities at all possible levels. Secondly, it is clear that in Europe has been Europe has started to develop step by step new mechanisms for a more redistributive agrarian policy. You know, far too long, most of the agricultural policy subsidies and other support went to the 20% of the richest farmers, yeah, which is an impossible situation, of course. We need more redistributive mechanisms. This is also meant to stop the very worrisome trend towards concentration of land in the hand of a small group of very large farms, yeah, which is one of the major, which will become a major problem in Europe. Thirdly, it's very important to open more spaces for self-regulation by the people who work in agriculture, self-regulation of those issues that can best be judged and managed by themselves. The principle of subsidiarity is to be applied to agriculture and the countryside as well. In the fourth place, we need inclusive development, both in Europe and in Central Asia. Too often, agricultural development has been a selective process, yeah, making many people, many farms redundant. I'm echoing the point also made by Sam Moyo this morning. Yeah, in the 21st century, we cannot repeat anymore the error that has been made in the previous century, that is to move many people outside of the agricultural sector. And finally, and this is an important point of enabling the policy environment, of enabling policy environment, we need to stop step by step by the perverse mechanisms yet that drain agriculture, that squeeze too much of the wealth out of it in order to be accumulated in food industries and large retail. This is a point that has been hotly debated in the regional debates. It is being discussed in the European Parliament. Everybody understands that when you put family farming in poverty, in misery, you impossibly can ask from them a contribution to food security, to cooling the earth, etc. These are the points I wanted to make. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Professor Jan de Wernde-Ploeg. I will pass the floor to Professor Sedo Schneider to synthesize the short paper on Asia and the Pacific, and I please ask Professor Sedgeshner to keep within 5 minutes, then we will give the floor to the special ambassadors. Thank you. You have the floor.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I will present this as the coordinator of the regional studies on behalf of Professor Yejing Zhong from China Agricultural University, and I ask you the license to present his PowerPoint that I would like to make it more narrowly that he will do it by himself if he could be here. So realities of farming, of family farming in Asia and the Pacific, it's more or less redundant to say something about family farming in this region because almost all the farmers in this region are family farms. And family farming is very connected to the historical and social context of Asia and the Pacific. And family farming in this region means a mean of production and social organization for rural life and rural community, adapting to scarce agricultural resources and condition of life in the rural areas. But family farming also means in Asia and the Pacific a cultural norm representing family ethics and the social bonds through the farming. So historically, especially in China and also in countries like India, just to give two examples, this historical roots go very far in the past. But finally and thirdly is also family farm is also an institutional arrangement that is consolidated through land reform and or recent legislation processes. The vitality of family farming in this region is especially through aspects like the livelihood maintenance and the self-sufficiency through local economies of scope and diversification and pluriactivity. In different countries of this region, the combination between production, agriculture, and non-agriculture activities in the rural area is far well developed and is explain the dynamics of the rural families. And also the vitality is through the biodiversity and agroecological sustainability through local specific integrated family farming initiatives and traditional agriculture. Modern agriculture and traditional agriculture is combining in this region, and the dynamic of the family farm is through this a nice combination of these two features, and also the relation between the rural and the urban in this region. Urban and rural are not split, are not broken, but they have strong grassroots and different kind of initiatives, especially in countries like China. But Professor Ye also in his paper called attention about the differentiation process of family farming, especially looking at China, because China it's a very important country. So even there is a process of social and economic diversification in the family farming sector in the region, and he especially called attention to the emergence of a kind of a group of families that became deactivated in terms of production, and other groups that are dedicated more to produce. So in this sense, He said explicitly in his paper, be vigilant to the capitalization of the family farm, in his words. Fourth, what are the main characteristics of family farming in this region? Family farming farming activities that primarily rely on allocated family and farmland, family labor and self supplied capital for household reproduction and subsistence. Its dependency on and involvement in external markets for productive factors is partial. So, and the features that are highlighted in the text that family farmers is developing are this one that are indicated here in the PowerPoint. So, you more or less you can see here. An identification between what Professor Ye is talking about and what Professor John Eichert just referred a minute before. Next, please. And what are the challenges of family farming in Asia and the Pacific? Professor Ye highlights three main points here. First, contract farming and raising capitalist way of production and organizing the farming, land grabbing, strong pressure of land issues, and migration and de-agrarization of the rural young people. So these are considering the three main phenomena that should be looked over in terms of the challenges for the family farming in the region. So next one. And finally, a reflection about the policy making, and which could be the suggestions on the follow up of this initiative. First, family farming have to look at the public goods, especially agriculture, should not be
fully true in the arms or in the area of the market, but family farming and agriculture, especially as a whole, need public support. So this is the point to the importance of the state that was already raised here in this morning. Second, consolidating the centrality of the family farming, protecting peasants from the land grabbing and proletarization. So in this region, the presence of the family farm in rural areas is really historical rooted, as I said, and also an important feature for the local communities. Third, he emphasizes peasants and food sovereignty and the contribution of the family farming for the global food security. If we consider that a great part of people live in this region and in the world, the role of the peasants and family farms for food sovereignty it's very central. Fourth, construction of new and decentralizing markets for the family for family farmers and for food safety. Fifth, facilitating and reconstructing and comprehensive rural development for continuing family farms. So it's to be enlarged the approach on family farm, not just on the production, but also on the infrastructure and other features. And finally, to acknowledge the multiple values of agriculture, recognizing and boosting value of traditional agriculture. So these are the message, these are the main the key points that Professor Ye sent for this meeting, and I, on behalf of him, present this as a summary. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Thank you, Sergio. We will now pass the floor to our Special Ambassador. I will start from Mr. Gelson Lettner, Special Ambassador for Europe. Please, Mr. Lettner, you have the floor.
Thank you. Dear colleagues, ladies and gentlemen, I am a family farmer with heart and soul. Our family farm in Bavaria dates back to the 15th century. This is the ability in deepest sense. I'm really thankful having had the opportunity to support the aim of putting the importance of family farming in the focus of the international agenda. This gave us a chance to communicate the role that family farmers play and the challenges they face worldwide. Countries and their governments organized different activities to raise awareness for hardworking family farming families. In my home country, Germany, for example, the public had the chance to visit farms during several open days. We showed 1,000 farms, and we had about 3 million visitors on our farms. This was a great opportunity to show the reality of family farms in an authentic way. There are two core reasons underlining that this UN year is more than important. First, hunger, malnutrition, and lack of agriculture efficiency are in some parts of the world still reality. Second, on the other hand, wealth and abundance in other parts of the world led to the fact that the important role of farmers has been neglected. I have exchanged with a lot of politicians and colleagues and with different groups of our society. I would like to share with you the most important questions I have been asked and the answer I gave in my role as Special Ambassador. First, which are the most important challenges for politicians regarding agriculture? My answer? My opinion is that there should be a legal certainty and political reliability. To put it short, good governance is the most important aspect of for a viable agriculture sector. There should also be a long-term planning, as farmers think in generations and investments in farms are not in no short-term decisions. Second, what do you recommend to your colleagues abroad to strengthen family farms. Farmers need to get organized in order to influence policies and political decision-taking. But we farmers only have a real power when we are with our organizations political and financial independent. This is a very, very important point for me. Furthermore, farmers should be strengthened by offering services to be able to compete on the market. Third question, which role can the UN play in strengthening family farms? I am convinced that the FAO can support farmers to receive more political recognition, especially in developing countries. First, the United States, nations, and the FAO should clearly emphasize that only autonomous, sustainable modernization and intensification of agriculture can feed a growing population. Fourth question, what about family farming versus outside investors in agriculture? Access to land and the protection of property are basic conditions that should be provided to make agriculture broad and diverse. There should not be any political interference on land markets, but now there's a very, very important point. Political framework conditions should guarantee that major investors do not turn agriculture into an object of speculation. Land grabbing is often a sign of bad governance accompanied by a lack of individual property rights. Corruption is a factor as well in many cases. We family farmer, we need the individual property rights, and I am fighting for it in my home country and all over where I make speeches and have political talks. How to catch the interest of young people for agriculture? We need education, vocational training, access to information and exchange of information are prerequisites. Communicate and promote farming is an interesting and diverse profession. Not at least, income opportunities and perspectives have to be attractive for young people. And we have to push to give the young people the feeling, the image, farming is a profession for the most strong, clever, and intelligent young people. It's a job for a winner. Farming is future. We have gives this image and this vision. Ladies and gentlemen, there's one thing which I would like to underline especially. The discussion on how agriculture should like are very controversial. A lot of voices claim that only small-scale structures in agriculture should be supported, thinking that investments should only be done to support small-scale farmers is a romanticized ideal. The Global Hunger Index 2014 recently been published. It shows that the number of people suffering from hunger has further decreased. These positive results are due to a general positive economic development. Agriculture efficiency needs to be enhanced. We need to produce more feed for a growing population. Putting the focus only on small-scale farming is not the solution to step out of the vicious circle of poverty. Small-scale farmers should rather be promoted to develop into profitable businesses. Ladies and gentlemen, at the beginning of this year, there were a lot of questions marked. What is the aim and what can be achieved? I'm happy to see which dynamics developed on almost all continents. This shows what family farmers contribute to our society. They provide our daily food. They contribute to a sustainable use of our natural resources. They take care of our cultural landscape, and they think in generations. It is crucial that the importance of family farming should not only be shown throughout the year 2014, but also beyond. And I promise I will act and work for family farms my whole lifetime. Thank you.
Muchas gracias, Mr. Solletner, y muchas gracias también por su compromiso como embajador especial este año 2014. Sin demora, le paso la palabra a la señora Esther Penunia, de Filipinas, embajadora especial para el Asia del Pacífico. Esther, por favor, tiene la palabra. Gracias.
Okay, thank you, Francesco. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I bring warm greetings from my organization, Asian Farmers Association for Sustainable Rural Development. I thank Professor Snyder for the presentation on family farming in Asia and the Pacific. Indeed, almost all of the farmers in Asia are family farmers. And a large majority of the family farmers work on land holdings less than 2 hectares. So we say in Asia and Pacific, we have small-scale family farmers. Yet, we produce 80% of the food in the region. However, out of the 800 million hungry people in the world, two-thirds, or 530 million, are in Asia and Pacific, mainly in South Asia, and many of them rely on agriculture and fisheries for a living. Why are we poor? Farmers from various consultations cite the following. Many of us do not have secured rights over the lands, the waters, and the forests we live on. This is aggravated by growing large-scale land acquisitions by private companies, sometimes offering quick, hard-to-resist money in exchange of lands, or worse, grabbing our lands. Good seeds are not readily available and affordable and have been out of our control. We do not have the capital for our production inputs and tools and find it hard to get credits and loans. Furthermore, we have high input costs, Asia being the home to green revolution. Sometimes we find it difficult to sell in the market because of bad roads, or to know where the market is because of poor market information, or to command good prices for our produce because it is of lower quality, or the market has much of it already. And now with globalized trade, we have unfair trade rules and large-scale land acquisitions. In this knowledge and digital age, we are still information poor. Women farmers are particularly disadvantaged as they are affected by socially constructed roles that inhibit participation in decision-making processes. And to top it all, we are most affected by climate change. Every year, we experience drought, typhoon, unpredictable weather patterns that affect our yields and our crops. What type of policies then might help farmers escape from this poverty? In the context of integrated, sustainable rural development, we need these policies, as we have discussed during the 2 regional consultations that FAO organized in the region. The first are policies on agrarian and aquatic reforms, those that secure rights to land, waters, and forests by family farmers. Governments can implement the voluntary guidelines on responsible governance of tenure of land, fisheries, and forests. Take relevant measures to improve cooperation and governance in the management of common property resources, and women's rights to land and natural resources should be strengthened. The second are policies that invest in public goods in the rural areas, roads, communication, electricity, irrigation, health, water, sanitation, weather forecasting, disaster preparedness, and management. Our labor force is our first and foremost asset. We want to have healthy bodies, minds, and relationships. The third are policies that help massively promote agroecology. Studies show that integrated and diversified farming, which is very common in the region, can increase yields from 20 to 60%, adapt to climate change and at the same time mitigate it. We can promote agroecology by giving the proper incentives, financing, such as low interest credit, crop and weather insurance, farmer-to-farmer training and exchanges, local seed banks, extension and research through in-situ farms, where farmers and professional agriculture researchers and extensionists collaborate closely. The fourth are policies that promote farmer-owned, farmer-managed agro-enterprises, mainly through our cooperatives or joint business ventures, which strengthen our participation in the value chain and access with local, domestic, and sometimes even international markets. We need regulations to ensure fair sharing of risk and benefits in contract growing and other supply and marketing arrangements, as well as starter funds, special credit windows, a system of tax incentives, support for storage and post-harvest facilities, various capacity building activities to strengthen the entrepreneurship spirit, the business skills of farmers, and build our agro and food processing skills. And also, as many of our countries are into global trade rules, we ask for macro trade policies that promote food as a basic right, promote a just and fair trade, and that promote the livelihoods of small-scale family farmers rather than threatening their displacement. The fifth are policies that promote gender equality. There is much feminization of agriculture in Asia, especially in South Asia, and yet many of the women farmers are not recognized as farmers. They are not given identity cards. The technologies are not appropriate and responsive to their needs. Their cultures and traditions prevent women farmers to travel far for trainings and meetings and to speak in public. The sixth are policies that attract the youth in agriculture. Our organization just had a consultation on this topic, and we are happy to note that, for example, Japan and South Korea have programs and incentives already to attract the youth in agriculture, providing small grants and loans for startup farm activities, as well as training from master farmers, from farmer organizations. And last but not the least, policies that promote the significant involvement of farmers and their organizations in policy-making process of governments. We know that many policies and programs may take more than a year to discuss, debate, enact, and implement. But we know that this International Year of Family Farming will just be a beginning. And we hope that this, the years forward, we can look more into the construction of a more enabling policy environment that truly invests in family farmers. In the Asia consultations, farmers have called for an international decade for family farming or an international year for our international day of family farmers to sustain this momentum of policy dialogues that will really bring dignified, decent lives to millions of small-scale family farmers in Asia and the Pacific. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Esther. I'm sorry. A nadie le gusta, obviamente, cortar la palabra, especialmente un embajador o embajadora. Lo estamos haciendo para procurar tener un poco de espacio después para poder hacer un debate en los 10 minutitos que nos van a quedar. Yo le paso la palabra, por favor, al embajador especial de la agricultura familiar de Norteamérica, Mr. Robert Carson. Please, Robert Carson, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very kindly, Mr. Moderator Pierre. And hello out there to all of you fellow family farmers. I'm a fourth-generation family farmer from the United States, coming from the area of North Dakota, which is next to Canada, kind of in the top in the middle of the United States. And before we came, my ancestors came to the U.S., we were farmers in Norway, also had some Swedes in the background there. So I come from a long line of farmers and am a family farmer and a fierce advocate for farmer-owned cooperatives, which I've spent my life supporting. I want to say, Mr. Moderator, that the International Year of Family Farming is very well received in North America. There are many activities celebrating family farming that have taken place across Canada, headed by the Canadian Federation of Agriculture, and many activities across the United States headed by the National Farmers Union. And I want to note here that even in a partisan divided Congress in the U.S., the U.S. Senate passed a resolution at the urging of the National Farmers Union to recognize 2000 this year as the International Year of Family Farming and to join in urging its celebration across the United States and give it official support. And I want to say, too, that family farmers in North America are really enjoying a good reputation as one of the most trusted professions. Recently, there was a poll done by a university asking which professions people trusted most, and policemen and nurses and farmers were all up there at the top, and I won't mention who was at the bottom. Family farms are, according to the USDA definition and according to the definition that we have at FAO, are 97% of the farms in North America, and Dr. Eichert mentioned that. There are 2.1 million farms in the U.S. That's down from a record number of 6.5 million in 1920. There are 230,000 family farms in Canada. In the U.S., only 7,000 of those 2.1 million farms are open stock-type investment farms, and that's been a number that's been stable for many decades. So family farms are the majority. Family farms are the most efficient ever in energy and input use. Greenhouse gas emissions are reduced. 70% of cropland in the U.S. and Canada is minimum tilled, and rotational grazing is very common, using a system to minimize the output of methane and to absorb carbon from the atmosphere into the soil. Now let me go directly to the issues that the family farmers who convened at the International Year of Family Farming Summit in Quebec, Canada, in April of this year set out. And there are four or five main issues that I want to mention, and then I hope that we get some good discussion here this afternoon. I'm perfectly ready for that. The first, there are two issues that adopted by the family farmers in Quebec at their summit that have a global implication, and the ones that are probably most important for you to hear in this global venue. And the first is to promote a new generation of farmers. That seems to be a global issue, and it was one of the top issues at this North American Conference of Farmers. The average age of a farmer in the U.S. is 58 years of age. The average age, I have read, of a farmer in Africa is 55 years of age. So you look at the aging of farmers in a developing world and in a developed world, and we have a problem, a common problem. I think that is a global issue that needs to be addressed, and I think we need to ask ourselves, why aren't young people going into farming? Why did many of the young people in my generation not go on to farm on their smaller farms that I grew up on? Because there wasn't enough money in it. Because farming, often family farming, was a life of not exactly poverty. We always had enough to eat and we always had a warm place to sleep on the family farm. But in many cases and in many years, the markets were unkind for price, or the weather was a disaster on the farm in the Great Plains. And so the family had to make do. And not everybody who is young is willing to make do. And I suppose I sound like an old fogey, and maybe I am, but we've got to deal with life as it is. And young people who go into farming now want to be able to make a good living for themselves and their family and to enjoy the kind of life that their cousins in the city have, and the same sort of opportunities that they have for family recreation and so forth. So farms need a profit. They need a profit to attract young farmers. They need a profit to be sustainable. They need a profit to be environmentally friendly. And those are things that young farmers need. Young farmers also need a government safety net. Farming's a risky business. We all know that. It's the most important profession in the world to feed people, but it's also one of the riskiest. And without a government safety net, we wouldn't have, especially for young farmers, the availability of loans to get started. And young farmers generally need loans. And then young farmers need, like I said, financing or loans and access to land as well. So I hope that is a global issue that we take to heart. The second global issue that the farmers adopted was this: ensure a decent income for farmers by enacting fair commercial rules. Well, what does that mean? It means that we have to examine the farmer's power in the food chain. Many farmers now are contracting their production to some company, especially in the chicken business or the poultry business, and also in parts of the world in the pork business or the pig business. And the farmer, and a lot of this contracting actually is moving to developing countries. We see less contracting in the United States because farmers have gotten, as we say, burned or disadvantaged by the contract and found out they were laboring as almost unpaid labor on a farm where the animals and the feed and the financing were all done by a large company, and the farmer really had no power in those contracts. And the World Farmers Organization, in concert with UNIDROIT, which is a terrible long acronym, but it's for an international group of farmers, or excuse me, of lawyers, not farmers, lawyers, they have come up with some model guidelines, or coming up with model guidelines for contracting that I think will be good, and that I think we should, when they're done, publicize at this level globally. We need a global study of food chain operation. International firms dominate retail grocery trade, processing, and shipping from farmers. Oh, I've already spoken almost too long. I'm going to look forward to questions. I realize I run at the mouth. So I would just conclude by saying this. The family farm is strong because it combines the social unit, the family, with an economic unit, the farm. And farming is both a way of life and a need to make a living. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Casso, and thank you very much also for understanding, for helping me in this difficult endeavor of allowing a 10-minute debate. Bueno, antes de dar la palabra, vamos a pegar acá 5 o 6 intervenciones. Quería decir un poco que estamos muy satisfechos con esta mesa. Yo creo que la mesa ha dado cuenta de la diversidad que es la agricultura familiar hoy en el mundo. Tenemos una gran diversidad de agricultura familiar, tenemos también una diversidad de opiniones sobre la política, sobre la economía, también ideológica, sobre lo que es agricultura familiar, cuál es su papel. Creo que esta mesa ha facilitado ese debate y ese es el rol de las agencias de Naciones Unidas, como agencias que producen conocimientos, ¿no? Facilitar el debate, hacer que todos los puntos de vista sean expresados. Y también por eso quiero agradecer a la previa discusión que ha sido tenido con las agricultoras familiares, que ha sido coordinada por Gianfilippo Dine de IFA, donde también se expresó esa diversidad. Bueno, son las 14:50, tenemos 10 minutos, a las 3 empieza otro panel, tenemos 10 minutos. La propuesta es que tomemos algunas preguntas, por favor, que sean cortas, breves, por favor, y de manera que le damos la posibilidad muy rápidamente a todos los profesores de responder un poco a las preguntas, por favor. Yo abro las intervenciones y ya tengo una, la verdad, que del gobierno de Rumanía, que quiere hacer una breve intervención sobre una conferencia que ha sido hecha unas semanas atrás. Por favor. El señor Teodor Dosa, del gobierno de Rumanía, por favor, ¿no está acá?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for the floor. Your Excellency, ladies and gentlemen, thank you. Forgive me the floor. I will be very brief. On 8 and 9 of October, the Romanian Ministry of Agriculture and the government of Romania organized a conference, Family Farm, the Core of Sustainable Agriculture. The meeting took place in the context of 2014 International Year of Family Farming. And Romania is aiming to develop the type of agricultural enterprise in the upcoming period. Based on the recently passed legislation, Romania facilitated the financing of family farms, offering guarantees to institutions that grant credit to the farmers and provide microcredits to farmers for purchasing the land, small investment, labor, capital, or converting their own contribution within the project financed by Rural Development National Program. The reality in the Romania is that 79% of the agricultural enterprise have between 1 and 5 hectares of land. So most of them are medium family farmers. Was a lot of discussion, a lot of topics, and after the conference was presented some good practices, like one of them, the Association for Supporting the Farmers Agriculture, talked about a program which took place in several areas of Romania and which consists in a partnership between consumers from the urban areas and agricultural producers in the neighborhood areas. In this program, practically the consumers receive a weekly basket of the local products, vegetables, fruits, eggs, and milks, based on the subscription paid in advance and at prices transparently calculated by the producers. Another example was presented about an ecological family farm, a successful business started in a village in central Romania, and there was a lot of other examples. So I don't want to bother you. So I just want to present this event that took place on 8 and 9 October, and thank you.
Muchísimas gracias.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We thank the professors and the special ambassadors for their very comprehensive presentations on family farmers. My question is, I think, to all of them, and that is, what can the developing countries' family farmers learn from the experiences that you have presented here, particularly in attracting young people to stay in rural areas to continue with farming and replacing their elderly families? Thank you.
Gracias.
Thank you. I'm Dr. Dinesh from India. First of all, I express my thanks to all the speakers. Since the morning, we have been hearing about various aspects of family farming, and all of us have become a little more educated on family farming by now. Two observations were made in the pre-lunch session. One was by Professor Mayo, that with passing day, the resource availability per capita is decreasing. The arable land is decreasing, the water, other inputs are decreasing. So the land holding has become smaller, the input is also getting costlier. Therefore, we have to take a variety of measures and interventions, the policy interventions, the program interventions at the global level, at the national level. But one of the very important aspects which I touched upon in the morning, and Mr. Carlson made mention of that, is the cooperative institutions. In most of the countries, particularly in the Southeast Asia and Asia Pacific, the cooperative institutions, which are voluntary and autonomous organizations, they are working at the grassroots level with the family farmers, and this provides them an opportunity to pool their resources and improve their way of farming and livelihood. So I was just thinking that apart from other interventions and policy and programs, we need to strengthen the cooperative model of doing farming at the grassroots level, because in coming days, cooperative is going to be the only answer with less and less land and capital with farmers. Thank you very much.
Gracias.
My name is Alpa. I'm from Seva, India. I would like to share some comments about we are talking about family farming, and we are talking about poverty, hunger, and rural development. So I have a very small thing to share that we in Seva strongly believe that the greatest source of imbalance is the distance between producer and customers. If both the producers and customers lived side by side, each would be accountable to each other. Both would expect fair wages, fair prices, and good nutrition produce, and neither would tolerate harmful pesticide, pollution of land, overproduction, or waste. And what is the alternative? If you remember Mahatma Gandhi saw that the village economy is the key to nation building. He believed that by closing the distance between producer and the customer, by meeting local needs with local skills, one strengthens the economy, one strengthens the community, and one lays the foundation of a society that is fair and equitable because it is accountable at every level. Along with these lines, I will also would like to say that where six of our primary needs, our daily staple food, shelter, clothing, primary education, health services, and banking services can be found within the 100 millions of radius. Thank you.
Gracias. Gracias por su intervención.
Thank you very much. I'm Khadija Razavi, an NGO Senesta from Iran. And I'm very glad to be here today. We, as a regional perspective and national perspective on family farming, we not only need the support, but recognition that today nearly 75% of the food of the world is produced by family farming. The agribusiness is producing only 25% after all the noise and publicity and fund that they have got. The agribusiness has got strong legal laws, regulation, rights, and everything is open for them, but the family farming nearly none. Yesterday, we think it's too late taking action of our national and regional policy at level for family farming. Today, unfortunately, in most of our country, land grabbing, mining became a natural use of land. And other one at a basis of big agribusiness, agrofuel. At the end of the day, you are saying that we have a lack of food. Today, still we don't have lack of food. It's a maldistribution and lack of regulation for the family farming. And I hope in this meeting and continuing to have really the most important part, the rules and regulation in the world and EU and everywhere. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you for the last intervention. I'm sorry if I have to stop here the intervention from the audience, but we will give the floor to the professors. I think the rest of the Global Dialogue will give us opportunities, many opportunities to speak on all these issues. I think I ask you all of you to understand the difficulty to manage a panel so rich of intervention which within a such short time. So I will propose the professor to please answer the different questions in 1 minute each. And I see that Professor Samoyo and Professor Ray Bush are somewhere in the audience. They are embedded in the audience. I please ask them to come upstairs and have the floor along with their colleagues. So the question raised was about young and family farmers, cooperatives, large-scale acquisition of land, the role of the rules, public intervention in agriculture, and agroecology. I please ask the five authors to have a 1 minute debate with this issue each. Thank you. Starting from Professor Jan de Ploeg, please.
Thank you. Let me take this issue of the decreasing amount of land and other resources per capita. Here I can be very clear. Being small does not mean, per definition, that a farm is second-hand, that it's unable to develop, that it is an obstacle to progress. Probably it's the other way around. Let me give you two references. In China, the average farm is one-third of a hectare. Nonetheless, China has been capable over the last four decades to realize a continuous increase in both production and productivity, whilst poverty has been reduced enormously. One-third of a hectare. Let me refer to the agrarian history of Netherlands and France. Small farms, but they contributed enormously to agricultural development and growth, and thus they contributed to the overall socio-economic development. What is to be done with small farms? We know exactly in agricultural universities. Yeah, we know how to improve and enlarge their resource base, to go step by step forward. What is lacking is increasingly the willingness of governments to create the enabling environment. There is the key point, and probably indeed organizations, family farming organizations and village communities have to take over a stronger role and impose and create that what the governments are not willing to create. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Jan, please, Professor John Eichert, your turn.
Once again, to stay within the time limit here and cover as much territory as I can. I know it's tempting to say that what will draw young people to the farm is more of what we've been doing and focusing on profitability. Unfortunately, I don't think that that's the solution to it. I think you do need economic development, and there may be some need for increases in size of farms in order to bring young people back to the farming operation. But I think most big farms today or large farms today are not unsustainable because they're large. They're large because they were unsustainable. And they focused on economies of scale rather than simply focusing on the quality of life. I spend most of my time working with people in what I call sustainable agriculture movement in the United States. These are young people. The big conferences that are being held across the country now are attracting many young people that are there looking for farming as a way of life. Certainly they want to make a decent living, but they want to be involved in an occupation where they can involve their family, they have friends, they're a part of the community, they want to be able to carry out their moral and ethical responsibilities to future generations, and that's what's attracting young people in the United States to more and more agriculture. The small farms can be more productive. We're not talking about going back to the past. We're talking about the benefits of agroecology and permaculture and holistic resource management. We can double, quadruple, fourfold increases in the smaller operations without adopting all the technology as the big farms. And yes, cooperation is an important part of it. The people I work with are working on local food systems, and they come together, have multi-farm CSAs, and they're learning to cooperate and work together to do things where they need to cooperate but maintain their independence as well. There are local food systems, community-based food systems. We do need microloans. We do need smaller operations. We need to help these young people who are creating a new food system to go out here and develop it, and we need that kind of development all around the world, in my opinion, not continue to do the things that have failed in the past. And to the last questioner, in the American or U.S. terminology, I would just say amen. I agree with you.
Thank you, Professor John Eichert. Please, Professor Schneider, please keep it within 1 minute, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What developing countries like my one, Brazil, and Latin America can learn with the policies for young people and for the rural? I guess, to be very objective, positive discrimination, policies for positive discrimination is very important. Maybe not for the whole time, but during certain period of time, it could be interesting, because without women and without young people in the rural area, there is no future for the family farming. So public policies have to discriminate positively, credit and stimulating for women's and for young people. There are different tools to do this.
And the point raised by a colleague from India, the distance between the producers and the consumers. I just would like to remind that most of food producers in the world is produced and consumed locally. So, but this is also out of the statistics. There is no information about that. So the countries and especially regional economies have to evaluate and have to give value for the food that comes from the local. There is a huge international debate about food that is flowing from South America to other around the world that is called the issue about food miles. And we do not can spend more energy to make food travel, and then that food can bring for local consumption. So there are schools in every small community, and children can profit from the food that comes from the family farms that are in the neighborhood, and also the local markets. And last point about the noise on agribusiness that have been done, I fully agree with you, and I guess that this initiative here and the International Year of Family Farming is the first step in terms to take off the invisibility that is still around in the world about what is the power contribution of family farming for our future. So this could be, in my opinion, one of the most important achievements from the International Year of Family Farming. So thank you.
Muchas gracias, Sergio. Por favor, Professor Samoyo, you have the floor. 1 minute, please.
Thank you. I guess it's an opportunity just to add a couple of points. I think the disturbing thing about the way people are discussing the transformation of agriculture in Africa is that it should follow the other trajectory of the Americans and the and the Europeans, that historically that is where we should be going. And this is very wrong. So because we are in a totally different trajectory. And, of course, the lessons from China, the Brazil and other places tell us that we could find another way in, okay? A way to transform in a more sustainable way family farming. So that's the first point I would want. The way we think, there's nothing about Africans that means that they have to follow an old, unsustainable model that's no more relevant in the world today. And this is not about Africans only. It's about the aid system, all the development agencies, the whole intellectual apparatus about describing and discussing Africa. We have to rethink it. What is the possibility? So that's the first thing. The second is I already mentioned this morning the idea of creating large estates and the consequences. It's been discussed with similar effects in other continents, so I don't need to say more about that. But there is a second attempt to discuss that the only viable and profitable way is to develop food regimes based on transnational concentrated food regimes. Okay, this is to say, the whole value chain debate, developing these value chains which are concentrated and have a broad global coverage. Now, we have heard already from other experiences how these are, in fact, working against the returns, the profitability to the farms. We know, for instance, in Africa, one of the most developed points around the food regime comes via the South African global supermarkets via South Africa and food chains spreading out through the continent. And in all places, this is so unregulated. It's only recently very weak institutions that regulate competition, collusion, and very poor information systems that don't tell us the misdemeanors that are operating in these markets. So we have nice supermarkets in some towns, but closing the space and opportunity for local farmers, replacing local food with imported, not only GMO foods and all sorts of processed foods. So we have to rethink this idea of local economies, local markets, including the lessons that we can learn about public procurement. And it's not just Brazil. The Americans have spent a lot of money trying to feed.
Please, Professor Moya, can you please?
Food stamps and all these. This is, and the subsidies that we have to find our own way focusing on these family farms. And so I just want to conclude by also saying that the one of the issues is that the narrative of Africa, because there was a debate with the colleague here whether we have a narrative, a pessimistic or a optimistic narrative. Well, it's a very uninformed narrative right now in the international, because we have insufficient investment in research and development science in the whole arena. So in every discussion, the critical mass of opinion on Africa is very limited. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Samoyo. Professor Samoyo, please. Professor Rebush, you have the floor for 1 minute, please. Thank you.
Well, thank you for this opportunity to come back, even though it's only for 60 seconds. There are some general observations to make that certainly appertain to the region that I spoke about this morning, but there are also some things that are recurring and are therefore a little bit troubling, because there are things that we can agree with, but we're not really quite sure how we're going to proceed beyond it. I'm very happy to have had a couple of interventions already about fishers. Fishing communities globally are the poorest in the world, and they are particularly affected not only by pollution, but also rising sea levels and global warming. So I welcome very much the observations about fishers. There's also a general comment that we should make, and that is about data. We all work with data. We work with FAO data, World Bank data, but it's not very good. And if it's not very good, it needs to be re-examined and it needs to be set about in a slightly different way. It actually requires a whole set of new detailed ethnographic studies to look at what's happening on the ground rather than from generalized macroeconomic observations that actually have very little bearing on what's going on the ground compared to the kinds of realities people are struggling with. The other observation that seems to be recurrent is that we are talking still, in a sense, about whether it's possible for us all to have an industrial future. It isn't. If we are all to pursue that, then we are engaging with collective suicide. So what's the alternative? It's actually the need to re-examine and explore what it is that farmers on the ground are doing. And the only way in which farmers on the ground actually will be engaged with much more in a much more constructive way is that if there can be policy that will valorize farming knowledge and farming family activities. Unless there can be a policy strategy to add value to small family farming, those policy rhetorics about all that we can agree with won't have much value. So it leaves us then with where do we go from? And it seems to me there are kind of two observations that are recurrent, one obvious and one really the elephant in the room. The obvious one is the state. We keep coming back to this issue of the state. What does it do? How can it do it? And how can it do it in the context of internationalization of capital, the World Trade Organization, and the need constantly to abide by the patterns of trade that are dominated by the most powerful? As a weak state, you can't deal with the most powerful on terms that are not simply asymmetrical. The elephant in the room, then, is what is the form of resistance? What is the form of opposition that can be taken? Of course, organisations like the FAO has a tremendous opportunity, and it's doing so currently with the issue of the year for family farming. But, I mean, how many people outside this room know there's a year of family farming? And that's a problem. And it's also a problem for social movements that are seeking to politicise the debate about family farming to engage with it more constructively at the level of policy. One policy that keeps reoccurring is this issue of land titling. I would beg to differ about the need to generalise titling per se. Titling actually is a policy and strategy of the most powerful, who want to lay juridical ownership to the land that they have. Most of the world's small farmers are operating around less than 1 hectare, or some people less than an acre. These are near landless. Titling isn't any good to them. They want land. They want more land. They don't want the security of the rather poor quality land that they've got. So there are some big issues. They're recurrent. We seem to agree with them, but how do we strategize and progress beyond them?
Thank you. Muchísimas gracias a todos los profesores, los embajadores, las embajadoras que han participado a ustedes en este debate. Yo creo que ese debate ha representado un poco, como lo decía antes, la diversidad de la cultura familiar y también la diversidad de nuestras opiniones. Muchas gracias.